Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Olivia Stalvey.
Today's segment of Labor Talk with Willie Terry focuses on the history of African Americans in the U.S. military.
Then Triple E segment, Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship, talks to Trent Griffin about his new venture, podcasts, Prison Bosses, people who come out of prison to become bosses.
And afterwards, we will hear from WOOC correspondent Corinne Carey. She sat down with Steve Greenberg from Siena College Research Institute to talk about the midterm elections. We will also hear from correspondent Peter Savio with his piece concerning climate change.
And later on, another segment from the homelessness series from Cat Jones. Let's start off with some rapid fire headlines. Construction equipment weird as students of the Capital Region Career and Technical School training program toured a construction site near the Port of Albany, all getting a peek at the day-to-day work they're on track to pursue after graduation this spring.
Albany County District Attorney David Soares announced Thursday he will no longer prosecute the two lowest tiers of marijuana possession cases. The policy change impacts anyone charged with possessing up to 2 ounces of marijuana, a misdemeanor that carries a maximum of 3 months in jail, or unlawful possessions of marijuana, a violation akin to a traffic ticket.
Wow.
Good news for you.
Okay, interesting. Muriel Manning, an acclaimed dancer who worked from the early 1940s until the end of the century, died this week. She was known for her work with the New Dance Group, a leftist dance organization dedicated to bringing affordable dance classes to working-class New Yorkers. Miss Manning said of the organization, they were mostly dances of political and social protests, sometimes satirical. 1 hour was for technique, one for creative work, and one for political orientation, Marxist theory, how to go into communities and teach the workers to dance. She was 95 at the time. God bless her soul. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
I always have warm regards.
WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the Underground Railroad History Project's first annual Veterans Day Remembers event on November 12th, 2018 at the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence in Albany, where he recorded remarks given by SUNY Albany Professor Oscar Williams on the history of African Americans in the U.S. military from the Revolutionary War period to the Second World War. This is part one.
Thank you. This is Willie Terry, your WOOC roaming labor correspondent. Sunday, November 11th was Veterans Day, and it was the day that the American people honored all those who have served in the U.S. military. Now, Monday, November 12th was the federal national holiday of Veterans Day, and I attended a program on Monday, November the 12th, that was sponsored by the Underground Railroad History Project. It was their first annual Veterans Day Remembrance event, and it was held at the Stephen and Harriet Miles Residence, which is located at 194 Livingston Avenue. Now, the Underground Railroad History Project, they research and preserve the local and national history of the anti-slavery and Underground Railroad movement, their international connections, and their legacy to later struggles. It engaged in public education and dialogue about these movements and their relevance to modern society. Well, on that day, I learned something that I did not know, and it was involving the Black Panther slogan. I always thought that the Black Panther slogan was connected to the Black struggle from the Civil Rights Movement in Mississippi and all the way to the Black Panthers. But I learned that it goes back further than that. That in World War II, there was a group of all soldiers, an all-black unit, called the 761 Tank Battalion, and they was known as the Black Panthers 761 Tank Battalion. Now, these soldiers were fighting soldiers, but they also had to fight the stereotype during that time. But they still went on to earn the nation's respect and an honored place in military and American history. Now, there was a book written by them, and it was written by former NBA legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, basketball player. Now, the name of the book was The Brothers in Arms, The Epic Story of the 761st Tank Battalion, World War II, Forgotten Heroes. And in that book, Kareem said that the 761st Tank Battalion was one of the most effective tank units to participate in hostilities during World War II. So I learned something, and if you get that book, maybe, you know, you will learn something too. Also at the program, they had a professor from the State University of New York in Albany, PhD, to make a presentation on the veterans, particularly black veterans, from the Revolutionary War all the way up to World War II, he spoke. And his name was Oscar Williams. I recorded that presentation. That's what you will hear next. Oscar Williams.
My first time being here, and it's a wonderful house. I'm very impressed by what's in here. Also, I'd like to thank you all for coming out. I just want to once again thank you all for coming out, and also to our vets who are here. I say that this is an honor and a pleasure to meet you, and I hope that my presentation on African Americans in the military does justice for you. Okay. As you see by my title, I am looking at primarily African Americans who served in the military from the Revolutionary War period through World War II. My reasoning for that is because it's important, I believe, in regards to history, to always look back at people who were able to make sacrifices through their achievements, through their efforts, so that people would have opportunities today. And I certainly don't exclude anyone who served past World War II. But World War II, as I was telling some people before, was the last war that America fought under a segregated system. But it was particularly that war that convinced the powers that be, for various reasons, that it was important to have a unified force and to not have segregation in the military. So my emphasis here is to look at those who came before, who, despite dealing with segregation, despite dealing with Jim Crow, nonetheless did their duty and did so under the most duress, but at the same time with perfection. So with that, I began my presentation. Of course, looking at the American Revolution, the Revolutionary War, I look at a couple of individuals. Now, it should be emphasized that African Americans have fought in every major war you can think of, okay? Despite dealing with racial segregation, racism, and the like, they served in every major war in this country, okay? And Revolutionary War would be the first of those major wars. Overall, there were 5,000 people that fought that were of African descent for the Continental Forces. An interesting thought, however, was that there were 20,000 that fought for the British. Was it because they were not patriotic? No, it was because they were practical. Why? Because the British said, if you fight for us, we will free you. So you had the majority of people of African descent in this country actually fight for the British. But my focus today primarily is on those who fought for the Continental Forces. Now, the first that tends to be brought up is this Crispus Attucks, who was a enslaved African-American originally from Framingham, Massachusetts, outside Boston, and found his way to Boston working a number of jobs. In 1770, he found himself also in the middle of a group that were fighting against British soldiers who had come to Boston. By that time, you had the British Army come to enforce various policies in the colonies, and Boston was the center of that. So in March of 1770, there was a armed conflict which resulted in British troops firing upon a group, or some say a mob, of people who were forming to oppose them. And Crispus Attucks was one of five who fell, mortally wounded. Later on, of course, during the Revolutionary War, or after the Revolutionary War, Crispus Attucks' role was emphasized even more. And he was emphasized that he was part of the first to die for the revolutionary cause. In 1775, when you had the war begin, once again we go back to Boston, you had the Battle of Bunker Hill. And in the Battle of Bunker Hill, you had a number of African-American militiamen, basically volunteer units from the area, come to participate in the battle. And there were a number of them. One was a gentleman named Peter Salem, who actually... But in the Battle of Bunker Hill, he is noted for mortally wounding, i.e. killing, a major from the British Army, John Pickering, okay? And these sacrifices of the militiamen were noted. And they also were observed by then the commander-in-chief, later on of the Continental Army, George Washington. But here's the thing. George Washington was a slaveholder. He owned more than 250 enslaved African Americans in his plantation in Virginia, which is Mount Vernon. And being a slaveholder, he was very uncomfortable with the idea of African Americans participating in the American Revolution. Despite this battle, he actually called for a ban against African Americans serving in the Continental Army. But like I said before, Great Britain had no qualms whatsoever in using African Americans. So as a result, Washington had to immediately reverse his ban order. So that by the end of 1776, you had African Americans participating in both sides of the war. Okay? Now, because of African Americans participating in the Continental Army, this created some interesting opportunities. One was a regiment which was created in Rhode Island called the 1st Rhode Island Regiment. It was essentially a collection of African Americans, mostly free as well as enslaved, who fought for this particular regiment. Now, interestingly enough, those who were enslaved, their slaveholders actually were compensated, or at least promised to be compensated by the British Army.
Thank you, Mr. Terry. We look forward to hearing the second half of this discussion. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM.
Tonight's guests on the show, Triple E's Education Empowerment Entrepreneurship, my good friend and entrepreneur, Trent Griffin from Prison Bosses / Podcast, talks about people who come out of prison or have had an experience with the criminal justice system and become bosses in the world afterwards. Tune in. This is H. Bosch Jr. of the Triple E's Education Empowerment Entrepreneurship. Today's guest is my good friend and entrepreneur, Trent Griffin, and we're going to talk about his new venture, mm-hmm. Prison Bosses. Welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about Prison Bosses, and I understand I'm going to be the very first interview.
That's right.
Well, we'll talk about that later on. All right. So explain a little bit about Prison Bosses and how did it come to fruition?
All right. So Prison Bosses, it was just a concept I had. I figured, you know, from my story coming from prison and then being able to work my way up within the hospitality industry and then switching over and actually using those connections to form my own business, I just figured there's so many of us, people of color, especially males of color, who've been incarcerated.
Absolutely.
And everyone tells us what not to do, but no one ever tells us what to do. And how we can be successful in the steps to take.
And that's what turns into recidivism.
Correct. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Keeps mm-hmm. that whole thing going yep. around in a around, circle.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so with this platform, I just figured, you know, I would love to get other individuals who have experienced jail in some form, let it be fighting the criminal justice system in court, let it be on parole, probation, or people who have actually did time in prisons and jails, and then the only thing that's needed to be a guest on my show is that you've turned your life around and now you're on the straight and narrow and you're successful. That's what success is.
That's it.
You know,
that,
it doesn't
that
have
that
to be.
You changed the path. You know, what was the famous philosopher said? Einstein, I think, said, "What is it? What do they call it? Insanity is when you do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result.
That's
you
right.
want to see somebody that's changed.
That's right. right. That's right. Yeah. I want to see how
they turned the setback into a setup for a comeback.
For a comeback. And okay. And so, and then out of that, I want those individuals like myself to be able to give the jewels of how they did it, what they did.
Oh,
and
man.
So that way, the listeners will now have a go-to guide on what I need to do so I can change myself around. Instead of people just saying, you got to be in at this time, you got to do this, you got to do that. No, how about we tell them what they should do so they can change their life and be successful?
Because so much of our experience was we came through it, but we didn't have nobody to talk to
us. Right.
You see, hear what I said? We came through it, but we didn't have nobody to talk to it.
So true.
Yeah, and
so
we had to still learn by trial and error.
That's right.
We knew where we wanted to go, but there was no trailblazer.
Correct.
There was no blueprint.
Correct.
You know, nobody that sat us down and said this and that. We just had to say, well, look, I'm tired of doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, let me figure out to do something different because that didn't work, and I don't want that
That's
to
right.
work.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. So, you're right.
Okay.
100%. Mm-hmm. 100%.
So then, where do we want to go with this? And tell me some of the ideas and platforms moving forward, you know? And where did, what's the long game?
The long game?
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, the way I envision it is to start off with, in the long term, one day I hope that, you know, I'm able to sit with some of the most quote-unquote successful individuals that we see growing up, you know, your TIs, people who have been to jail, have come home and now are successful on so many different planes.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I would love to then, just based off the brand and the relationships we have, to be able to start making some real change. And hopefully this becomes the gateway to us, as a community, helping others who have come home from prison so that they in jail so that they can turn their lives around.
Okay, so tell me how the apparatus you've set up to do it, where you're recording from or how you're going to record or how you're going to connect with guests. Because, you know, like this, what we do here in the studio format, give me a little education around that. How's that going to work?
So honestly, I'm taking it on the road. I want to interview people where they feel comfortable until we get a space like this where, you know, people could come. So I want to go to people where they feel comfortable.
Right.
I want it to be just a conversation between two individuals who understand each other, like-minded, and I just know from the energy that people will feel it and feel how real it is. And ideally, you know, That's where we're at with it right now. You know, it's not like we have a big studio or anything. We're just coming out and we're doing this, you know, guerrilla marketing style from the ground up.
I like that. So I also like you're willing to come to people's offices,
mm-hmm.
People's place of employment, mm-hmm. because what really makes that so good is that shows they turned their life around.
Definitely.
Because if you go to somebody's place of work or what they're doing, it's like, well, obviously, they're doing something totally different.
Totally
right. And not only do we want to talk about it, at this particular time, we want to be about it.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
Whatever they're doing, it shows, like you said, the premise of the show is I want to speak to people who turned their life around.
That's right.
And they can show that brother out there on the corner that's literally staring poverty in the face.
Mm-hmm.
I did it.
That's right.
I turned around.
No,
you know?
It's true.
So then, are you working in collaboration with someone doing this, or you just said, hey, this is, how long was this idea out there before you started putting it in?
So, I move kind of quick, but.
Ain't that true? Remember what I said earlier, as long as we stay moving, they never catch us,
that's
right?
So true, yep. So true. Got to keep
moving. In the right direction.
That's right.
On the right side.
In the right side of things.
Yes, sir.
And so, I had the idea in my head, I want to say maybe a good 2 months, right? And, it sat on my mind. I had a lot going on, and I was consciously pushing it to the back of my mind. Like, why does this keep popping up in my head? But I have other things I need to focus on. And I was just talking to my wife one night, and I told her my idea. She loved it. Told my brother. I started sharing it and telling
so
people.
So when you share an idea, it's kind of like planting a seed.
Right.
It starts to grow and grow and grow.
Correct. Yeah. And I was explaining to them, like, I can't shake this idea from my mind. And so then my brother actually started doing some research, and he was like, bro, there's nothing like this out here. He was like, and you could talk, you'll be talking to millions of people who go through this all the time, and especially our people.
And so. People are, black and brown.
Correct.
You know? When we always stay in contact through social media, and when you shot me the info, I said, look, man, could I please be involved?
And
you
know? I was happy. Yes, definitely.
And then to find out that I'm the first, man, I am truly honored and humbled.
And you know what? I love your story, and people familiar with your show, I'm sure, know your story.
Mm-hmm.
So, but for me knowing you, I know your story. And the thing I really loved about your story is in how I felt you would be so beneficial to this was you were a minority business owner.
Absolutely.
You know, so you can tell the jewels about that.
From the top of my head to the bottom of my
toes.
Feet.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you fought the criminal justice by yourself.
Spoke
you know?
Truth to power.
There it is.
Mm-hmm.
And so, many of our people every day are going through this system in which they're afraid to fight.
Right.
You know, they cop out. They take what they're given.
Yep. Because they automatically think, Brother Trent, when they throw those football numbers at, sometimes they condition themselves to say, well, maybe I did.
Maybe I should.
Yep. And just throwing the constitutional rights right out the window.
Yep. And
you know, last time I checked, we got the same constitutional rights as the people in the suburbs.
We definitely do.
You know, only, why not exercise?
It's true. It's true. And we've been so conditioned, like you mentioned. Like, I mean,
conditioned for plea.
To plea. I was incarcerated with individuals that I'm telling, fight this case, fight the case. And they're just like, no, I know people who went to trial and they did. I know people. It was never, I know someone who actually won. It was never that. They didn't come with that mentality.
No.
And
they're so afraid to walk.
Correct.
You know, like,
correct.
Well, if they said it, they must have all kinds of.
Correct.
No, that's
correct.
Their job to say it.
How about
that's
this?
That's their business to put you away.
And it's true.
Their business is not to make it easy for you to walk the plank.
Right.
So make them work for it. And I always tell people when I share my story, I said, listen, it was like blackjack.
Mm.
I had 19. They had to come with 20 or 21.
That's right.
I'm sticking, brother.
Yes.
So if you beat me with 20 or 21, then it must have been
be
something
it.
There.
Correct.
All right?
I agree.
But you got to come with it.
You
got to
come with it.
Yeah,
you got to. And we got to break these conditions. And so this is what the show is about, us breaking the conditions. I mean, you know, slavery and it did its purpose. It's worked, and it still works in so many ways. And so we got to start breaking those thought processes, and we have to be the voice. We have to be the ones to share with our communities that they can beat these situations, that they can go to jail and they can come home and they can turn their lives around. Or how about we change the narrative altogether, and eventually one day it'll be beautiful if we don't have to talk about going to jails and prison.
As I told people, they said, what's your end game? My end game with what I do is I want to go out of business. I want to go bankrupt.
Right.
If I go bankrupt, that means there ain't no more wrongful
mission complete.
Convictions.
That's right.
There
That's
ain't
right.
no more wrongful yes. prosecution.
Yes.
You hear what I'm
yes.
talking about?
Yes.
This
yes.
is the one business that I want to go
please.
Out of business.
Please,
in.
Please, right. Yeah. Please put me out of business. Right.
So if I'm out of business, then there ain't no more wrongful prosecution. I'll be glad to go belly up on this business.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. If one day Prison Bosses doesn't exist because we don't have to talk to individuals
How
coming home
that?
From jail.
How about that?
Then mission complete.
Mission accomplished.
Agreed.
So tell people real briefly then a little bit about your history, you know, in terms of your history and what you're doing now before we close out.
All right.
And what I can expect in the interview. Okay.
All right. Perfect. Mm-hmm. So a little bit about me. And this is just real quick. I got myself in trouble, completely own it, at the age of 19 for selling narcotics. I had a 4 to 12 year prison sentence. I did 3 years off of that, came home and had to start from the ground up again. Mm-hmm. And worked a lot of temp agencies and just anything to keep me working and out of trouble. Eventually, I landed a job with the hotel, entry level, cleaning toilets. I took that position and I owned it. Next thing you knew, I was getting promotion after promotion. It was from houseman to front desk supervisor to operations manager to general
you
manager.
Took whatever you could have just to stay, keep the ball moving,
keep
down
it
the
going.
Field.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing I did every day was I showed up. And I put my best foot forward at anything I did. And I looked at everything as on-the-job training. Like,
right.
the more knowledge I could gain from this, the better off I'll be someday down the line.
Great.
And so, I worked hard at night. I would go home at night and study what a GM does, because that was my end goal. Learned the language, how what they talked about, the lingo of the hospitality industry. I taught myself how to read P&L reports and sheets. I just took everything on as the opportunity to learn.
Great.
And from that, I was able to now work based on my reputation. I was able to get 9 hotels from Jump to partner with us in providing transportation. I started a shuttle service. Today, we work with over 50 hotels across the area, a lot of big businesses, and we're still growing.
Great.
And but, you know, all of that, my experience just should be inspiration to others that you can do anything you want to do as long as you are willing to work hard.
Great.
And as long as you understand the importance of education.
So let me, before I close out, what can I expect doing the interview?
So right. So Prison Bosses, the podcast is going to be about a 20 to 30 minute interview in which I will be sitting down talking with other individuals who have been incarcerated in some form, shape. And we will be talking about just different challenges that we face. So we have different segments like cops, POs, and COs, in which we'll discuss, you know, what we learned from being around these different different positions of power, how to move around these positions of power so
Great.
You could be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to talk about different things like, you know, on the chow, just the importance of, you know, I hated that. But by the way, when they used to say on the chow for lunch, but the importance of putting healthy food into your bodies.
Absolutely.
We're
going to
talk about, you know, just all different topics that you can incorporate with another one, gang, talking about, you know, in jail, there's such a heavy gang presence. Mm-hmm. And we're going to correlate that with on the outside, your gang needs to be a strong group of individuals who are doing the right things.
That's the right gang.
Who are pushing mm-hmm. you in the right direction. So
okay,
we're
going
to be correlating prison talk to corporate talk.
Good.
And showing how they all correlate and how you can go from A to B, by doing the right things.
Great.
And dropping those jewels on how we got there.
All right, well, real quick, we're going to bring you back, all right? Because
right.
this is going to be a to-be-continued conversation.
All right.
All right, I'm going to close out, and then we're going to definitely have you back, okay?
That sounds
Until
good.
Next time, focus about the triple E's, education, empowerment, entrepreneurship, all right? And remember this, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe. Thank you so much, Trent Griffin, for stopping by. You're my good friend. You're an inspiration to so many. And what you do is a true, true blessing. And you are a true agent of change. Looking forward to having you back real soon, sir.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
How about that? Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corrine Carey sat down with Steve Greenberg from Siena College Research Institute at the Ale House. Great, great, great place to eat. And Troy, to talk about polling, the midterm elections, and what the results mean for New York State.
The Siena College Research Institute has been around since 1980. We have been doing the current incarnation of the Siena College poll since 2005. And we do statewide polling virtually every month, polling New Yorkers on their views on elected officials, candidates, issues, what they want to see government do. And then we also do pre-election political polling. This year, our biggest year ever for doing that, we did 7 different congressional races in New York. We did the statewide campaigns 3 times. We did the Democratic primary 2x. And in partnership with the New York Times Upshot, this year, Siena and the New York Times did polling in more than 60 congressional districts in 27 states in the United States between Labor Day and Election Day.
So when you say you did these polls, what is this? Is this when somebody gives you a call, identifies themselves as with Siena, and asks, what kind of questions do they ask?
Well, earlier on in the cycle, we were asking more issue questions as well as the quote-unquote horse race question. But in those final weeks, the final 2-3 weeks leading up to Election Day, we wanted to be able to do polls in as many different congressional districts as possible, as close to the election as possible. So we really limited the size of those polls down to, in various congressional races, favorable, unfavorable about the 2 candidates, a horse race question, who are you voting for if Election Day were today? Which party do you want to see control the House come November, after November? And do you approve or disapprove of the job that Donald Trump is doing as President of the United States? That was it. And then some demographic questions, age, gender, income, things like that.
Why is polling important?
I don't necessarily say that it's important. We can have elections without having polls leading up to election. But I think polls are a public service. What it does is it provides the public with an understanding of the world they live in. Sure. So we can tell people Cuomo's leading Molinaro or Katko is leading Bolter. But it's also about telling people what their neighbors and what their fellow New Yorkers think on issues from abortion to the American flag to Medicaid to environmental issues to criminal justice issues to budget issues. Over the course of the last 15 years at Siena, in terms of our polls of New York State voters, I think we've probably asked in excess of 200-300 different issue questions. And we report that so people know. I will often hear when I tell people one of the things that I do for a living is that I do polling, people will say to me, you know, I don't understand. The polls are all wrong. Everybody I know hates Andrew Cuomo, yet you guys have him up in the polls. Well, more so than ever, we live in silos. You only listen to and interact with people who believe what you believe. You know, either you're a Fox News watcher or you're an MSNBC news watcher. There are very few people.
Or you're a WLOC listener.
Exactly. But there are very few people who routinely watch both Fox and MSNBC. We've become siloed. So people, you know, interact with, talk politics with people who feel like they do. So this is an opportunity to explain to New Yorkers, gee, I know everyone you know feels this way about issue X, but you know what? You're all in the minority because the majority of New Yorkers feel this way.
I think polling got a very bad rap after the 2016 election. How did pollsters do this time around?
I want to take back and challenge the premise of the question because pollsters did get a bad rap. You're exactly right, but I think they got an unfair rap. Why? If you look at the final national polls that came out the weekend before Election Day in 2016, ABC, Gallup, NBC Wall Street Journal, there were probably four or five polls that came out in the final 3 or 4 days of the 2016 campaign, national polls, that all had Hillary Clinton winning by 1, 2, or 3 points. Well, you know what? They were all right. Hillary Clinton won the national popular vote by 2 points. So those polls were all accurate. The problem was, and shame on the pollsters for this, they didn't pay attention to the right states. There were no late polling going on in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan. Everybody, all the pollsters, all the pundits, all the talking heads were focused on Florida and Ohio. I think the pollsters missed a little bit in terms of the states they were polling. Had they been polling Wisconsin and Michigan, we may have known that Hillary Clinton's so-called electoral lock was not, in fact, locked at all. It really wasn't the polling that got it so wrong. And this year, I would say, Siena had a great year. I mean, I think pollsters in general had a good year, but there were so many close elections. I mean, I'll give you an example here in New York. In New York 19, our final poll, completed the Sunday before Election Day, had Delgado up by a point. You know what? Delgado won by a point. I think we got that one dead on right. Our final poll in New York 22, completed the Sunday before Election Day, had Tenney up by 1 point. Well, it now looks like Brindisi is going to win by a little less than a point. Did we get that one right? I would say we did. I mean, yes, we said the wrong candidate, but we were within a point and a half of the final vote margin, and we did say it was going to be close.
I'm talking to Steve Greenberg from Siena College Research Institute about polling and the recent midterm elections. Can understanding the polls help a get-out-the-vote effort?
You know, it's a great question. It's a double-edged sword. I think our final polls, and I'll use New York 19 and 22 again as examples, I think our final polls there should have said to both campaigns, the two Republican campaigns and the two Democratic campaigns, something that they already knew, but reinforcing, this is close. We need to get out every vote we can. So I think it helps the campaigns to say, okay, people, the polls are close. We need your support. And I think it tells voters, you know, look, we complain that our vote doesn't matter sometimes. Oh, you know, I live in New York. How I vote doesn't matter. It's such a Democratic state, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. I've heard that complaint from New Yorkers. But when we tell you this race is really close, you have no excuse. So hopefully it does incentivize people to say, huh, there's that old cliche, every vote counts. I'm going to go see if my vote counts. I'm going to go vote today because this is a close election. The flip side of that is, we've heard complaints over the years, you know, if we come out and say candidate X is leading candidate Y by 20 points, that we're disincenting people to come out and vote. Because, oh, what's the reason? Why do I have to go bother? You know, they're up by 20 and that's not my candidate. Polling should help inform you. It should not make decisions for you, whether who to vote for or whether or not to vote.
The top line after the midterms was that the House is now controlled by the Democrats at the federal level. But here in New York, there are some other takeaways from the midterms. What are some of the big ones?
Certainly the biggest is the state Senate flip. You know, the Republicans have controlled the state Senate for all but 2 years in the last 60. The Democrats are going to take control for the first time in a decade, and we'll see what they do with it. But they didn't have a victory on Election Day. They had a huge victory on Election Day. They flipped 8 Republican seats. So we go from having a 32-31 Republican Senate to now a 39-40-23 Democratic Senate. So the Democrats have a huge advantage there. The other big takeaway for me this election day was there was a blue wave. Now, there was no national blue wave, but there was clearly a blue wave in New York. How do I know that? 4 years ago, the turnout in the midterm election was 36%. 36%. Nearly 2 out of every 3 voters, registered voters, didn't vote in New York. The turnout 4 years before that, in 2010, was 45%. I was really hoping we were going to get close to that again, that we were going to bounce back up from 36 to 45. We topped 50. The turnout in New York was the best it's been in a midterm election in at least a decade. More than half of registered voters in New York actually turned out and voted. New York City, in an average midterm election, accounts for maybe 28, 29, 30% of the statewide electorate. This year, New York City accounted for 34%. That may not sound like a lot, but given how overwhelmingly Democrat New York City is, that makes a huge difference in terms of the statewide turnout. And so we saw Democrats coming out to vote in midterm elections this year, unlike what we saw 4 years ago or even 8 years ago.
So what's the result for New York? What are we looking at now when these elected officials take office in January?
Well, we're going to have the same governor and lieutenant governor. We're going to have a new attorney general, the same controller. We reelected our junior senator. But it's interesting. I look at this. We have four statewide elected officials, a governor, a lieutenant governor, a controller, attorney general. We have two United States senators. We have two legislative leaders, a speaker in the assembly, a majority leader in the state senate. Come January, of those eight elected officials, those leaders of New York, four of them will be men, four of them will be women. Three of them will be black, five of them will be white. Three of them will be from New York City, three of them will be from the downstate suburbs, two of them will be from upstate. I would say the elected leadership of New York State is starting to look a little bit more like the population of New York State. And to me, that's one of the bright spots coming out of this election.
As a part of her series on real experiences with homelessness, Kat Jones spoke with Joseph regarding his adventures on the road, unlike most of the people Kat has been interviewing. On this subject, Joseph actually chose to be homeless. He's mindful that his experiences are much different than someone who did not have that choice, but he still has an interesting perspective to offer.
So, Joe, you said you have had some experience with homelessness. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. 2010, right after college, I decided to go hitchhiking across the country. And my first homeless experience after spending some time in Texas, it was just a lot of, finding out the lifestyle more and adapting, where to find places to sleep at night. It was kind of an adventure every day, I remember. I just remember when I was in Santa Barbara, California. It was my first time sleeping outside. It was a Salvation Army setup where they had the homeless people sleep right outside the place, but then they had to wake you up at 5 o'clock in the morning to start your routines or whatever and kick you out of there. So I don't know. I went through a lot of days without a shower and stuff, but it was very adventurous and I loved it a lot. Yeah.
So you were homeless by choice, right?
Yes. That's correct.
So how do you think your experience differs from someone who maybe didn't choose to be homeless?
In a lot of ways. I don't think I struggled as much as those who were homeless. You know, I had a home to go back to by choice, while some others probably in a more unfortunate circumstance where they didn't have a home. And I don't know, I can't really say because I'm not in those positions. But I would definitely say much more difficult than my experience, yeah.
What would make somebody want to be homeless that had a choice?
Probably just for new experiences. And after reading The Road by Jack Kerouac, I think you just kind of get a whole idea of how it's kind of romantic or whatever to go out there and live a life that's free, quote unquote. And that was pretty much what was my mentality at the time. And to see new places, meet new people, and just to get some a bigger understanding of life.
Nice. So how long were you homeless?
I want to say for 3 years I was hitchhiking, and then I did return home, but then I lived out of my car for the third year across the country. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the biggest challenge you had?
I don't know. Let me think. Staying stinky free every day, I guess, may have been the worst challenge. Yeah. I mean, getting food was okay. There were some hungry days or whatever, but I didn't I just saw that as part of the reality as opposed to a huge challenge. I don't know. Maybe getting along with some certain people too. I feel there's just people out there that may not like you very much and may not agree with what you're doing. And so if you're emotionally sensitive to that kind of stuff, that could be kind of challenging too, because then you lose hope in people. Yeah, that's the biggest challenge. keeping hope in humanity. Yeah.
So you think people treated you different because you were homeless?
Sure, some did, yeah. I did see how other homeless people were treated by, like, people that had homes. So, yeah.
So you learned a lot about humanity in general, but some of it wasn't great from the sound of things?
No, yeah, there's totally, like, a dark side to it all, too. You know, the beauty that there is, too. I just remember, like, I don't know, like... Oh, yeah, I do remember one time I was trying to use my cell phone charger at this coffee shop in San Francisco, and I kept waiting in line to be served, and the line, every time I got closer and closer to, like, the clerk or whoever, she kept ignoring me, like, blatantly, and, like, 30 minutes had passed, and, like, people kept getting served before me. I didn't know what was going on, and I guess I realized, you know, I had my pack on, I probably smelled, I had, like, this really weird-looking hoodie on, too, and as soon as, like, I spoke up to, like, get her attention, she remember her reaching for the phone, and I just thought, I'm like, oh, my gosh, she's gonna f***ing call the cops, like, so, yeah, like, I just, moments like that sometimes would happen, like, you just get totally, like, treated differently like that, and treated like you're scum.
But sometimes you met good people out there, too?
I met some wonderful people. I met some angels. I met a homeless man who gave me his coat one time in Santa Cruz, California, because the night was really cold, and he just didn't need one. And I had a coat, but he gave me an extra one anyways.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah, no, I met some really wonderful, wise people, too. Yeah, definitely.
Nice. Do you think that maybe there's something about people that live on the edge that makes them more amenable to solidarity and mutual aid?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I feel like, you know, I feel like it's kind of the philosophy where, like, you lose it all and then you gain so much more on the inside. You know, a true, like, divine, like, humility and humbleness towards the world around you. And I feel like, you know, if you stay in touch with that, that's going to resonate with everything and everyone around you. And, yeah, I've been around, like, those wonderful auras across the country. And, yeah.
Thank you so much. Is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you?
Just, you know, don't be afraid to learn new things and to push yourself to other boundaries. Yeah, that's all.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kat and Joseph. Peter Salvo with Al Hicks and Kelly Pleza is in part two of a discussion about climate change from the perspective of the Citizens Climate Lobby.
Okay, welcome to segment two of Climate Matters. We're pleased to again welcome Al Hicks and Kelly Plessis from the Citizens Climate Lobby. Our last segment, we focused primarily on the challenges, risks, and some of the science behind climate change. Today, we're going to move on to shift our focus a little bit more to the solution side, both on a policy side and on a technical side that the CCL, or Citizens Climate Lobby, puts in front of us. Once again, just want to share the kind of the mantra that helps guide us. The Stone Age did not end because we ran out of stones. And also to add that if folks out there have suggestions, questions, or issues they'd like to raise, feel free to reach out. And you can do that via email through climatechops@gmail.com. Climatechops, C-H-O-P-S. That's challenges and opportunities. So moving on to the opportunities, the solutions. The climate change can be a lot to take in. What are the solutions that CCL is proposing?
So CCL is focused on national legislation, and we head toward this goal by working with our Congress people to push climate solutions forward. We participate in getting members toward the Climate Solution Caucus, which currently sits at 90 people, 45 Republican and 45 Democrat.
That's congressional representatives, right?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah, and Citizens Climate Lobby is a nonpartisan group that's looking for economic solutions that are not regulatory in nature. So the basic belief is that we can't solve this unless both sides of the aisle are are on board. Mm-hmm. And so you got to come up with solutions that both sides can agree with. And certainly the Republicans are not interested in regulatory approaches to things. And they want a market-driven solution as opposed to a government-driven solution. So the basic concept is what they call a carbon fee and dividend approach. And right now in our society, we are subsidizing fossil fuels to a very great degree. So when you go to the gas station and buy a gallon of gas, the price that you pay only reflects a small portion of the true costs, and we in society are covering the rest of those costs. If the thinking is that if the cost at the pump truly reflected the real costs of carbon, then all the other sources, the green sources of energy, would be far more competitive, hugely more competitive, and people would just naturally be drawn to those green solutions. Now, when you put fees like that on products, and people aren't interested in paying more for taxes on gasoline or anything else. So the solution to that is to not take that money and put it into any government programs or anything of that sort. The idea is to return all of the income generated back to all the households, equally divided among all the households. So it would be a progressive tax, so that the people that make the most money typically spend more on carbon-related items than the people that make the least money, but they're all getting back the same amount. So I believe it's about 60-70% of the people would do better financially.
Mm-hmm.
And those 67% are the ones at the lower end of the market. And if you had you didn't like the idea of spending your money on these high gas prices, then you go and look for an alternative.
Great.
And that driving them away from the carbon is what we want to do.
Excellent. We're here with Al Hicks and Kelly Plessis from the Citizens Climate Lobby, a group here in Albany seeking climate solutions. You are with us on Climate Matters at WOOC. So what makes CCL different? Explain again, the fee and dividend sounds a little bit complicated. How does it actually work? I mean, is there going to be a different line on every receipt I get, or how is it actually going to work?
So what happens is the price is put to the people that are producing the oil and these fossil fuels, and so they pay more when they're creating these products. And then, of course, because the way life works, those prices would come down the line, so consumers would pay more in turn. But this money at the top is then taken and redistributed into society, and everybody would get a portion of that money. And like we discussed, people at the lower income rates would get more money back because they tend to spend less on these products and resources. And what they found is that people who get this money back would probably be able to put more money and would do so into their healthcare needs. So there's a lot of benefits that come out from this.
And when you say that they found that the money in terms of the dividend might be an advantage to the lower income and middle income people, correct me if I'm wrong, did that include IRS research that indicated such findings, or was it a think tank or academia?
You always have to ask the tough questions.
I would actually have to get back to you on that. I can't remember at this moment who did this research, but I believe it came out of CCL itself.
Well, there's economists across the board. All of them agree that the way to reduce carbon consumption is to put a price on it, to increase the price. And I cannot, of course, I can't remember my name half the time, but...
It's Al, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I knew. I can't tell you the exact citation for how the distribution of money came, but there's been a number of studies that suggest that this would be a good thing.
Gotcha. And if any of our audience happens to know, reach out through climatechops@gmail.com. On to CCL again. Could you tell us a little bit more? So how often does CCL Albany meet? What kind of things do you do at your meetings? When's the next meeting? How do I learn more about Citizens Climate Lobby?
Well, we meet monthly at various locations, often up in the Colony Town Library has been our historic location, but we've moved around to a number of different locations. And our, as Callie had said, our main goal is to promote federal legislation because it is at the federal level where you have international boundaries where you can assess fees and make what they call border adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to put a tax on carbon here in the United States and Canada didn't, well, actually it's reversed. Canada has such a thing at the moment. But they would have an unfair economic advantage. So we basically tell them that, okay, we have this tax within the United States. Anything coming into the United States has to pay an equivalent fee so that it levels out the economy. There are a number of great TED Talks,
mm-hmm.
One by Ted Halstead and another by Bob Inglis that explain the whole concept of fee and dividend very, very well. And you can just Google either one of those guys and you can have a much finer presentation of the issue than I'm capable of presenting, that's for sure.
I'm not so sure about that. Thanks to Al Hicks and Kelly Plessis for helping us to better understand pretty complex issues in terms of climate challenges and opportunities and kernelizing them through what CCL is doing. Thanks for joining us for Climate Matters.
Thank you, Peter Savio, Al Hicks, and Kelly Pleza. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Olivia Stalvey. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thank you for tuning in.